You're listening to the Sportsman's Nation Podcast Network, brought to you by Exodus Trail Cameras. In case you're not familiar with Exodus, all of their cameras are backed by a five-year, no BS warranty, and even includes five-year theft and damage coverage. They simply have the best trail camera warranty in the industry and have the customer service to back it up, right? The best part about that is their cameras flat out work, period. Now, April 2nd and April 3rd, they are running a 20% off special off the Trek and the Lift 2 cameras. That's 20%. All you have to do is enter the discount code April, and you're going to receive 20% off your purchase. So go to ExodusOutdoorGear.com, take a look at their cameras, and take advantage of the special offer.
Welcome to another episode podcast here with Land and Legacy. This is your host, Matt Dye, and my co-host, Adam Keith. He is down and out, a little sick under the weather. So we've got returning guest on the podcast, Mr. Brian Tao. How are you doing, sir?
I'm doing good. You're going to have everybody confused. You know, last time I was on was talking about wet stuff, and now we're going to be talking about a totally different subject.
Just
almost total opposite.
Yeah. Upland versus bottomland. So that'll, hey, but it kind of goes to show, again, the passion is about land, the passion's about habitat, and all the creatures and critters we care about use both. So, man, how's this last week been? Because really, I think we talked about wetlands last week, is that right?
Yes, sir. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, we talked about wetlands last week, and this week, you know, was just work-wise was, you know, again, busy, did a little bit of got a little chainsaw work done, but also spent some time with a drip torch getting some fire on the ground as well.
Certainly. Well, that's awesome. That kind of leads us right into our topic for today. And this is one of those topics that is so incredibly wide from your burning grasses to timber, from spring burns to fall burns, to everything in between, the fears, the pros, the cons, everything that revolves around putting fire on the ground, utilizing prescribed fire as a disturbance to manage the habitat. That's what we're talking about today. But before we get into that, just a quick reminder about the QDMA Steward 2 course. That is September 13th through the 16th. Early bird special has run out, but don't forget to sign up, as that's going to be a fantastic event held in Southeast Ohio at a client's property. The folks from QDMA, of course, are going to be there educating people. Kip Adams, Matt Ross, Joe Hamilton, Craig Harper, and many more will be there. So please join us for that event if you haven't done QDMA Steward 1. Be sure to take that course ahead of time and sign up for 2 as well. You'll be amazed at the amount of information shared within these courses, and it'll make you that much better of a land manager and deer hunter as well. So check that out at QDMA.com. Brian Tao.
Yes, sir.
Fire. I know that you are obviously well-versed in land management, love to utilize different disturbances, specifically natural ones. But, you know, in the right setting, oftentimes we get the question, okay, well, if I don't use prescribed fire, what else could I use on the landscape to replicate something similar? And that's a great question, because I think, like we said earlier, you know, prescribed fire, there's pros and cons, and a lot of, you know, sometimes fears built around that. So there's a lot of substitutes out there, or I shouldn't say substitutes. There's a lot of wannabe substitutes out there for prescribed fire. What are some of the common ones that you see landowners inquiring about or hoping that this other disturbance or other mechanical means may be sufficient or suffice as a substitute for prescribed fire?
Absolutely. Probably the one that's, I would argue, that's probably the second runner up for me is probably disking.
Yeah.
And this is under obviously very you know, very unique circumstances, because I'm a, you know, just as you guys are, I'm a big proponent of soil health, mm-hmm. and sometimes disking can disrupt that or disturb, you know, some of the microbial activity and some of the natural things that occur there. You know, however, you know, it is a disturbance, and yeah. it is something that, you know, it's something that can help promote, you know, some of the species that we want to see. Mm-hmm. Oftentimes, you know, similar to prescribed burning, you know, oftentimes when I think about disking, I think about at least something that I want to promote when I want to promote broadleaf plants, sporbs and legumes, so to speak. Mm-hmm. Think about disking in the fall,
sure.
August, September time period. You know, disking is probably my second runner up. The other one, you know, you can do some level of it, you know, some level of that disturbance also with a bush hogging.
Right.
But, you know, bush hogging would be another one. Herbicide is also one as well, which, you know, because essentially what you're doing is you're knocking back some of the undesirables and trying to promote some of the desirables. So herbicide can even be another factor in that, you know, all of which have their time and their place. I mean, that's anytime you're thinking about, you know, burning, disking, herbicide, you know, bush hog, I'll be honest with you, I consider bush hog to a lesser extent as a tool in my tool belt.
Right.
But, you know, even a bush hog can be of some benefit. But all of it, again, to me, is just a tool in the tool belt that we pull out under the right circumstance when we need it the most. I mean, it fits a key. You know, there's a reason traditionally why we pull out one or the other over the other. And so, you know, I'm thinking about those. That's kind of how I view them. But those are probably the three big ones that I would think of. You could think about chainsaw, but oftentimes even chainsaw alone, just like bush hogging, oftentimes doesn't do it. A lot of times there needs to be a herbicide treatment to follow those.
Sure.
So it may be, you know, some of them, fire can do a variety of things, but, you know, that is probably more beneficial for us, but we can sometimes combine other tools in our tool belt to equal that. But, you know, there again, probably the cheapest of all of them would be fire. You know, if I'm going to look at my tools that I have to grab, fire is probably the cheapest one. And that's another reason why it's kind of my go-to.
Yeah, definitely. You know, I think no matter what you're trying to do to the landscape, obviously what's on the landscape in a given area determines these practices, you know, whether it is prescribed fire, whether it is herbicide, chainsaw, brush hogging, or forestry mulcher, or there's one other one that we listed in there. But, you know, what's there, the composition of that vegetation really helps determine that. And then again, time of the year. But one of the ones that commonly seen here, you know, as we're traveling around, touring properties and working with landowners, that is a lot of people are getting into, I think, from the maybe the fun of running the piece of equipment, but skid steer and forestry mulching. And there's many different types of varieties of these mulchers out there, whether a drum or kind of the bush hog deck or whether they've got carbide teeth on a wheel, you know, whatever they are, let's just say it's a mulcher. A lot of people, because it is a type of disturbance, are trying, from what we're finding and seeing and discussing with landowners, trying to utilize that almost as a replacement or a substitute to bringing prescribed fire onto a property. Of course, there's a lot of things, you know, to unravel in that and break it down. First off, number one is that type of disturbance, even though you are truthfully resetting vegetation, a lot of times it happens to be, of course, woody vegetation, but even though you're resetting the vegetation, it still does not have the same effect on the land or those acres as prescribed firewood. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. It just because, you know, number one, as you, you know, the key there too is you're specifically targeting woodies.
Right.
And, you know, that's something that can also be done with a chainsaw, you know, similar to what we do maybe with PSI. Oftentimes I see the rotary mulchers or the rotary mowers, whatever you want to call them, you know, or forest mulchers. oftentimes you see those again with like cedars and more softwoods, because sometimes you get in the hardwoods, especially you try cutting up a blackjack oak with a forester
melter. The whole skid steer is going to be rocking.
It'll do it. it'll do it, but it's going to take you a while, and it's going to be, I think it's going to rock you pretty good. You know,
it's a lot of wear and tear on that equipment.
Exactly. A lot of wear. Exactly. So, you know, but, you know, again, it's a type of disturbance, because I think that what you're doing is you're definitely opening up the canopy and allowing sunlight to the forest floor.
Yep.
But that doesn't always accomplish that goal of truly promoting what you want. I mean, and what I mean by that is, yes, it is accomplishing a task. And if I was to run fire through an area that had a closed canopy, I'm really not going to accomplish what I want either. I would, and what I would argue is that mulcher is definitely in many situations is something, maybe the first step.
A preliminary.
Yet I don't know that it's necessarily the last step.
Because, absolutely.
Just simply because, you know, there's many seeds that need to be scarified by fire. You know, it requires that heat has a hard outer shell, so to speak, on the outside of that seed. That allows many of the seeds that we like and that we want to promote oftentimes in the, you know, out across the landscape. That's what allows them to sit there and sit there and reside for decades.
Lay dormant in the seed bank. That's what we're talking about. You know, hey, has your seed bank been disturbed? And what are the disturbances that are there? You know, disking, obviously that will disrupt and make those seeds unviable. But if they've been laying there dormant in the seed bank because of these hard shells around them, they're you know, potentially viable still. And we're talking 20 years, that kind of time length on some of these seeds.
Or longer. I mean,
much longer.
And because it's amazing, pretty amazing once you run fire across the landscape and open it up to sunlight as well. You know, what pops up, how much native vegetation is already there, how much seed is already there. But like I said, the mulcher, I think, is, you know, I don't want to take away from it, but I think it's a tool and it has its place, and it should be utilized, you know, as often as it needs to be used. But yet, I don't know, I wouldn't say that it totally replaces fire.
Absolutely.
You know, maybe
not.
It may be the first step leading up to fire, or a step just prior to.
A couple things there in that you mentioned, Brian, that I'll piggyback on and take another route with. The opening up the canopy, specifically in timber, obviously. Prescribed fire in closed canopy timber, and we see this a lot. Again, it's beneficial, but it runs its course in a matter of a few weeks as the canopy then opens up and you have complete leaf out. Your sunlight, your energy source for the growth that was happening on the ground is completely cut off. So removing and opening up the canopy is 100% necessary to get the expression on the forest floor that you're looking for. And I think that concept right there, whether it's shows or documentation, blogs, video, whatever it is, has not highlighted the fact that for optimal regeneration, you have to have sunlight through the entire growing season to get the response that you're truthfully looking for in timber, timber settings. If you don't have sunlight, you don't have one of the three things that you need for plant growth: soil, water, and sunlight. You need it. You have to have it. And we're seeing limited results. And I think, again, people's perception of the fire is they're doing a lot of good. And again, it's better than not burning your timber, but we're missing the follow or the initial step of opening up that canopy, whether it was with a mulcher or whether it was with a chainsaw or whether it was with a hack and squirt treatment on some, you know, TSI beforehand is incredibly important. Another thing that I've seen a lot with the forestry mulcher is that much debris on the ground in the form of mulch, when it lays against the ground, it absorbs so much moisture. And when it rains, it takes a long time for those wood chips to dry out. And a lot of times, if you're going in there and doing a lot of heavy mowing or brush hogging in timber, saplings, this and that, and you have a lot of mulch on the ground, it's very tough for then a fire to come through in comparison to going ahead and hacking and squirting those trees, letting them die, standing and dry out. And then when they do fall over, they degrade so much faster, or they're consumed by the fire because they're dry. And or chainsaw, when you just drop the whole tree, the fire will still go through a canopy tree top, because, you know, most times that canopy is open. It's not holding that much moisture, whereas that mulcher creates a blanket of just wood chips on the ground. And a lot of times the fire will get to that and just smoke and smolder and won't continue up, you know, throughout the rest of the fire, the burn area itself. Have you seen that yourself?
I have, you know, definitely, like, as you said, it depends on how much is mulch, you know, or how much is truly chipped. But, you know, that it can be a factor. But, you know, the biggest thing is that what, you know, in doing that, you've got to make sure that you know, obviously you can't control. I mean, you can't control how much mulch and how much chips you're going to put out there, because you got to do the job you got to do if that's the tool you have at hand to utilize. And that's the quickest, fastest way you have to get it done. I totally get it. You know, so it's also good to understand too, you want to get that fuel off. You know, and that's the one instance. And what I mean by that is because that much fuel could down the road lead up to more problems or more issues, if you do not remove it. You know, the other thing too is I feel like, you know, and it's, you know, we touched on this, but I think it's good to point out too, that we talked about, you know, closed canopy forest and burning and totally remove it. You know, while I'm kind of hitting fuel there, we also have to realize, I mean, you can just, you know, run fire through a closed canopy forest and just to remove potential fuel for potentially getting too hot, you know, and causing other harm or other dangers. And the other thing with that mulching is that sometimes you may want to run fire through it. If it's a heavily wooded forested area, you may want to run fire through that, burn the leaf litter off. If you've got a thick stand of leaf litter, I think it's good to go ahead and remove that leaf litter
before you add more fuel.
Exactly. Right. And, you know, and then at the same time, what you also do is you let that, you know, it'll be 2 to 3 years traditionally that you would come back through with fire, you know, at least. So, you know, what that does is that just puts some, I don't know, that stuff becomes degraded and starts to decay a little faster. It becomes more organic, you know, more organic material, and the leaves just kind of pile on top. So, you know, and then the leaves kind of dry out. And so it's, you know, so that's something to consider is if you're going to do a lot of heavy mulching, what I would probably do is remove that fuel that's there, which is the leaves. If it's very thick, then come in and mulch. Now, obviously the one caution is that once you remove that leaf layer, you got to watch, you know, if you're using a big, heavy piece of equipment, you know, a skid steer with the forestry mulcher isn't as big, but if you're going to use, you know, one of those great big mulchers, you know, you may cause more rutting, if you do it after rain or something like that. So just tools. You got to kind of weigh your options, look at what it is, look at the situation, look at where you're at. You know, but, you know, I also realize you could use them for cedar removal out in, you know, in more grassland and open areas. Mm-hmm. So, I'm not opposed to doing it, but I think I still think fire is going to be a key component in that.
No, without question. And we're talking about various tools that are all in the toolbox for a land manager, or, you know, or an option out there. So there's not a situation, honestly, that you get to every property is like, well, you got to do this step, and this step, and then this step. every acre, every slope is just a little bit different. And so the prescription and the way that you would go about it to get the end result is going to be a little bit different. And that's based, again, on time, resources that you have to be able to devote to this. But I can't stress enough the importance, though, of having a plan first off and a goal and a direction, and then from there determining your best route to get there. And that's why, you know, the forestry mulching may play a factor into it. The chainsaw work may play a factor into it at some point. Hacky squirt may play a factor into it. But at no matter what, prescribed fire, once you get it set, or preliminary, may be the best route. Then you get it set, and prescribed fire is the maintenance tool. The phase, yeah. The maintenance phase to keep that habitat at that place. I think the biggest thing, you know, what we're seeing is that forestry mulcher or the brush hog is trying to be or take place of the fire in the maintenance phase of a property. And I think that's the kind of, if you will, the no-no of, hey, there's more out there that you could get out of the land if you introduce the prescribed fire versus just brush hogging and trying to use that as a replacement for prescribed fire in a maintenance phase. So would you agree with that?
Oh yeah, no, I would agree 100%. Just simply, you know, you need to do what you feel comfortable with, and it's a tool. It's that tool in that tool belt that you, if you don't feel exactly comfortable with it today, you might go ahead just to ensure that stuff doesn't get too far along or too far away from you, mm-hmm. that you go ahead and you might do some mowing, you might do some bush hogging or some mulching or what have you, but don't exclude the fire. And regardless of what your mom told you, you know, you do not pee in bed at nighttime if you like fire. So, you know, but, you know, at least I don't think so. My wife hasn't complained about it yet. So, you know, but long story short, though, is that, you know, it's when it comes to fire, if you're, you know, you should always have respect for it. And, you know,
absolutely.
People, you know, what I tell folks all the time is that if you're not scared or at least have some respect for the fire, then I don't want you anywhere near a match.
Yes.
You know, I mean, you know, if as long as you have some fear or some respect for that fire, I'm okay with that, because then you're not going to get too carried away. You're not going to do anything necessarily that I'd rather somebody be too cautious than not cautious enough.
Right.
You know, when it comes to stringing fire and working with fire. And so, you know, just because you might feel uncomfortable with it doesn't mean, I shouldn't say uncomfortable, but just because you have a little bit of hesitation with it, that doesn't mean that's a bad thing. That's what you'd want. Don't let that hold you back. You know, that little hesitation to hold you back because you don't truly understand it. Now, I mean, granted, I'm in Missouri, and I have some benefits here that other folks may not have, such mm-hmm. as, you know, to be honest with you, we can pretty much string fire in most locations.
Yep.
There are some more urban areas. Some, you know, I've got a friend that, you know, has some property in Jefferson County. Mm-hmm. It's a suburb of St. Louis area. And long story short is that, you know, they can't string fire. I mean, he's got a really nice old field. Mm-hmm. Type of setting, about
yep.
15 acres, and he just simply cannot use fire just because the fire department will not allow him to do it. It's just something that it's there's a permitting process, and it's kind of a bureaucratic nightmare, as they say.
Sure.
So yep. You know, so they do it a little differently. They do it with a combination of disking and mowing, you know. But you know, that's a situation where you kind of have to roll with the punches. But you know, in many, you know, other states and other areas, you know, that's going to be another key factor to pay attention to as well, though, as to, you know, because fire may be something that may be a reason why you don't have fire in your tool belt, is because just simply because of your locale or your location, you know. But in most states, there, you know, whether it's the you know, your Department of Natural Resources oftentimes has a program or an assistance program of some sort or a guidance program that will, you know, help you with, you know, becoming a little more familiar mm-hmm. and a little more, you know, hopefully alleviate some of those fears of fire as well. And so the best thing to do is go through those programs, research it. You know, like I said, here in Missouri, we're kind of fortunate because, you know, our state agency does hands-on programs, you know, to where you have a fire training for landowners. Anybody can go to it, but it's called a landowner burn workshop. And then a part of that, the second part of that is actually to get out on a prescribed burn. And you know.
That's weird.
Hello.
Hey. That was
what
weird.
Happened?
I don't know. I just said call failure. Just like dropped it.
Huh. I wonder if it was my phone. Wonder if it's my phone for some reason.
I don't know.
If you had trouble, you know where we're at.
Yeah, I'm at home. I don't know.
Well, no, I was going to say, do you know where we're at in the talk?
Oh, yeah, yeah. You cut off, right, you're like, or basically you can pick up and say, what Missouri offers, or the second part of the class would be going out and actually being a part of a prescribed fire.
Gotcha. Yep.
Feel free, whenever, we'll take a quick pause here and then jump in there.
Okay. You know, here in Missouri, we have the second part to that whole training course or that landowner workshop is you actually go out and you get on a fire. They have a prescribed burn set up to where you actually get out there with it and get on a fire with trained professionals, and it kind of helped guide you through it. I realize that may not be something, a luxury you have in your neighborhood or your area, your state or region that you're in. But, you know, I highly recommend you take advantage of anything similar to that, just because it does help alleviate some of those fears and some of the hesitation you might have with fire. And trust me, you're not going to be the first time or two you do it. I have no doubt that you're going to have all of those fears kind of well up and be there. But, you know, it's. What I would tell you is, if you have caution, you have reservations, just add more people.
Yeah.
You know, just have more people and equipment than you way more than you think you need, and you know offer cold Pepsis and steak after you're done, and you know just anybody that shows up and anybody that you think's halfway responsible, and just have more people and, like I said, more resources than what you, that would be my biggest recommendation to anybody, to help alleviate some of those reservations.
The biggest thing on prescribed fires is eyeballs, you know, just having people watch the line after you've dropped the flame. You know, you want to continue and progress that, that backing fire off the fire break itself. So you got to, sometimes maybe it's walk around a corner or get out of sight of some of the fire. So if you have people staged up along that fire break watching, make sure that you're not having anything jump. You know, you're watching flame heights and everything like that, and you're in good communication with them, you know. Having those people is certainly essential and makes your peace of mind that much better as you're continuing to execute the prescribed fire. You know, and that goes back to, you know, the amount of acres that you can do and the feasibility of prescribed fire as a tool to manage lots of acres in a short amount of time in comparison back to the maintenance or, you know, trying to substitute a mowing job versus the prescribed fire. When you're looking at time and resources and equipment that needs to be done, you know, I can't tell you how many acres have been burnt by having backpack spray, backpack blower, rakes, and drip torches, and that's about it.
Right.
From an equipment standpoint, and covering in an afternoon with the right weather and right prep work, so fire lines have already been, you know, installed and are ready to rock and roll, we're talking a couple hundred acres in an afternoon that's been if you will, maintained, how long would that take from a mowing standpoint? Long time.
Yeah. Hey, you know, and you hit a big point there is, which is when it comes to the fire line and prep work, if the day of the burn really should be a nice, relaxing day.
Mm-hmm.
If everything goes right, if conditions are right, and I don't want to get into specific conditions because
sure.
it does vary from grasslands, what
Absolutely.
You might want compared to woodlands or maybe even certain, a glade compared to a savanna or a woodland burn. But the prep work should be done ahead of time, and the day of the burn, it really should be just a matter of stringing fire.
That's
and
right.
And that prep work is a fire line construction. If it's grass fields, it's as easy as having, a disc line around it.
Yep.
And this is an occasion where, once again, I think a bush hog is really, really good, can be a key factor, because if you've got really tall grass, right up against a portion that you want left unburned or a neighbor's property or whatever, I really like to bush hog a lot. I like to bush hog a line down.
Right.
And get that height, that flame height down, so to speak.
Certainly.
and so if that's going to be part of my line, then I want to get that on the ground. That way it's only a couple inches to maybe a foot tall compared to being 10 to 12 feet tall potentially.
Right.
Another point to where at least mowing can be a factor, but it is just a benefit to my fire.
That's
or
right.
To my fire regime. But more than anything is, that prep work that goes in ahead of time is what really matters. Everybody thinks that when you're lighting the fire is the big point, and it's really not.
Right.
I mean it is there are some key essential elements to that day that can dictate some, whether or not it stays in the fire line, so to speak. But really and truly, it's the prep work and the work done ahead of time that really and truly matters.
And there's a lot of things that you can do on an annual basis from fire lines and setting up the property appropriately that alleviate a lot of the work up front, before fire. The fire season, if you will, from a hunting access point of view. Golly, I'm having a tough time tonight here. From a hunting point of view, you want to access your property from the outside in, and so developing that road system from a overall point of view of a land manager, you want to go from the outside in. So there should be a road system or a nice fire break already established. A permanent one that you're accessing the property with, and that all you might have to do is just either disc it right real quick or come in with a backpack blower and just blow off the leaves, and you're ready to rock and roll. It's not like you're having to constantly reopen a lot of fire lanes if you're setting up the property from a hunting access standpoint appropriately, and a lot of the other fire breaks that you might be using are internal road systems, and that's certainly highly variable across a property, or maybe it's the edge of an ag field or the edge of a food plot, whatever it may be. But a lot of times the hand built line tends to be pretty minimal, so just maintaining those fire breaks. And another thing that can be done is planting those in a perennial food plot, like a clover or broadcasting wheat, the fall before you're to burn that fire line, just so there is some green vegetation in there as well, just to make it that much stronger of a fire break, an established one. There's a lot of things that you can do ahead of time that all go into the property improvement and huntability of the farm by implementing prescribed fire there.
Oh, absolutely. Just make it as easy on yourself as you possibly can. And utilizing those existing roadways, and as you said, food plots. If you're, say, it's an old field situation or a grass situation where you're burning grass, don't be afraid to plant a clover, as you said, a clover or wheat strip, around that, and kind of have a green line, so to speak, that as in a green perimeter. And you know, utilize as much as you can to your favor, and to minimize the amount of work that you have to put in, you have to do. But you know, there is one that I can't wait to hear more about it. Mm-hmm. But there is one situation on the interior that I can think about it. And I tried this, and I'll tell you the results that I had were unfortunately slightly different. But Marcus Lashley with the University at Mississippi State University, you know, he's doing some really neat research just on fire in general, all different perspectives on fire and habitat. Part of it is, you know, timing of fire, which is actually, and he's looking at more timing of fire in woodland settings.
Yes.
Promoting some broadleafs, forbs and lagoons, more in timber tracts, but one of the things that he did that was pretty neat, and I don't know if you guys have touched on this or not, but you can actually go to their podcast and they actually,
Deer University. Burning, right?
Yeah. Deer University, I believe.
Yep. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. And, they're on their podcast, they kind of highlight it too. Dr. Lashley kind of highlights it a little bit, but he calls it bow stand burning, to where he's just simply going in there, blowing a line real quickly, about 30 yard circle around a tree stand location. Mm-hmm. And, but he's doing it actually in the fall, about a month prior to hunting season opening.
Right.
This may not work in all locations. I mean, this may not work if your dates, say that the northern locations is northern part of the U.S. is where I could see this being a little more minimal.
Yep.
Probably having, because the growing seasons are shorter. But in the vast majority of the country, I think you can probably go in there and do this, just simply burning a 30 yard circle around your tree stand, and the results in the deer increase was tenfold.
It was
right in that location.
Yep. And yeah, what that was just a response from the woody vegetation resprouting, and all that new growth was certainly attractive. The browse added around that circle around the tree stand. Like I said, their sightings and their hunting efficiency drastically increased. And that just goes to show you that, okay, holy cow, if I can do that in and around stand locations, which is a very viable option, as they're proving right there, what does that look like from, the greater landscape of the property? I'm going through and doing 80 acres of that through that, and let's say in the springtime, I've got so much vegetation that is offering high quality forage and attraction to those areas, as well as the cover aspect.
Right.
There's endless possibilities to be able to do that. Right. You don't have to necessarily just neck it down to, okay, well, there's a road here, there's a creek here, or a river here, or a food plot edge here. That's my unit. You can go and do specific areas that you're going to be hunting. But again, that is just goes to show a perfect illustration of deer and the landscape and the vegetation is adapted to prescribed fire. And it's for a good reason, because the way plants grow and the way that the landscape used to be was tolerant to these disturbances. It's natural for them to experience prescribed fire. A lot of species do much better with that on the landscape than not. And as we see, wildlife then quickly respond to that type of disturbance. I was talking to someone the other day, and oak hickory forests, they're obviously adapted to fire. And one of the ways that we know that they're adapted to fire in comparison to, let's say, North Slope, that's just chock full of maples, is look at their leaves. When the leaves fall in the fall and they begin to dry up, how do they dry up? All the edges begin to curl and they form a if you will, bowl-ish-like form. They don't just lay flat against the ground and allow moisture just to get packed on top of them. When they curl, it allows wind to get under there and dry them out, making an environment suitable to carry fire. Whereas in other climates and other types of leaves and situation, they don't do that. So if you're predominantly in an oak hickory setting, or should be and not anymore, your area, your landscape, your acres, your property should have fire there
to be able to manage that landscape. It's mind-blowing. But truthfully, so many areas of the country, whether, again, your plains, you're down south in the pine country where there's longleaf or shortleaf pine savannas and mixed grasslands, or you're in oak hickory forest, those landscapes were basically utilized prescribed fire to maintain them as such. Again, those were lightning strike fires, or a lot of Native Americans use prescribed fire from a management standpoint.
And it gets more into the hunting side and more, but it kind of highlights
that dependence by wildlife. But just in my travels, you know, I've been fortunate enough to travel across the country, literally chasing turkeys. I hate them that much with a passion. I want to kill them all.
Right.
But,
yeah, right.
You know, but yeah, but, no, and when I go anywhere, you know, and I've got this habit, oftentimes I end up on public land, quite a bit. But one of the first phone calls I make anytime I'm looking at a location or we're going to a location, I call the area biologist or the area manager and say, hey, when and where have you run fire through anywhere?
Yep.
And, you know, and it's whether it's chasing Osceolas, you know, down in Florida, you know, or out in Kansas. I mean, in Kansas, or my Florida hunts, they had already been, those areas, the Palmetto Flats had already been burnt, but obviously they were heavily packed with turkeys.
Sure.
Then go to Kansas. It's amazing. You go out there and literally the Kansas Parks and Wildlife might be, one location we had a house in which we sat on the back deck drinking cold Pepsis and watching the Parks and Wildlife burn off a field right off our back deck.
Yeah.
You know, and that very next morning, the smoke was still coming up. Mm-hmm. You know, they burnt most of the night. That very next morning, there was turkeys in the middle of that. In fact, we shot a couple turkeys in the middle of that black while still smoldering and smoking. And I've seen the same thing in Missouri.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and just, you know, when you start looking at, you know, what happens immediately afterwards, I mean, you know, because that immediate response, obviously, from turkeys is you got a bunch of, you know, you've got a bunch of golden roasted bugs that are laying there. They're
easy
a whole lot
pickings.
Easier to catch when they're stopped and they're still, you know, and, you know, who doesn't like a good grilled bug?
Yeah.
But,
to scratch anymore. All the food sources that they would typically scratch are just, it's a wide open canvas. Honestly, what it's like is a monoculture crop field of soybeans. They don't have to dig through anything. It's just there. It's just available. It's all the food you want. Come and get it. And that's what it does for the turkeys. It's immediate responses. You don't have to wait weeks. It's immediate in most locations.
Yeah. You know, and then over the next few days, as things start to green back up, you know, deer roll in and they browse on it. The turkeys still browse on some of that green stuff popping up. But
all the same thing. You got bugs, you got seeds, just like you said. It's all right there and it's a smorgasbord for them. So, you know, but once again, that kind of shows and highlights some of that dependence, you know, of, you know, on fire because it helps promote that. And, you know, and just to, but I think what really highlights, you know, the environmental dependence in most locations on fire, especially, you know, and when we're talking about dependence on fire, oftentimes we're not talking about wetlands, you know, wetland areas like we were last week.
Yep.
We're talking about more upland locations. But that dependence on fire is highlighted by something I said earlier, by, you know, as opposed to just simply using a bush hog or just using that forestry mulcher, you have a seed bank there that needs to be scarified. That heat, it requires that heat to pop that outer shell or that hard shell to actually allow that seed to truly germinate and respond. And that shows you that it's fire is a part of the environment.
Yes.
You know, and you know, I grew up, I was born in the bicentennial, 1976. So, you know, I grew up in the era where you wake up on a Saturday morning when you're watching cartoons, you got Woodsy the Owl and Smokey the Bear, you know, that were on, you know, in between a lot of commercials for the cartoons that you're watching.
Right.
And especially Smokey the Bear did a tremendous, you know, campaign. I mean, but you know, that initial campaign was only you can prevent forest fires. But if anybody's paying attention, or you paid very close attention, and some of you may have even seen this, you know, but they have since, the U.S. Forest Service has since changed that campaign, that slogan, to only you can prevent wildfires.
Right.
Simply because, you know, they did a really, really super good job of showing we need to, you know, suppressing fire, because, you know, oftentimes we as people, we oftentimes think in absolutes, meaning that, you know, we think if that's good, then, you know, if fire's bad, then we should take all fire away. Well, that's not exactly the case.
Right.
And, you know, and once again, those grass seeds are kind of a, I think, the perfect example of highlighting why we actually do need fire, is because those native plants that have adapted here, that have been here, that God put on this earth, was made for fire. And so, you know, that's something when you kind of, you know, when we start thinking about it, we really need to, you know, to look at that. And, you know, the one thing about timing a fire, though, that I'd point out is we definitely want to look at it, because we have, you know, we don't want to be running stringing a lot of fire from about April 15th to say July 15th in
right.
grasslands specifically, you know, even in the woodlands from some point, I mean, because, you know, we're going to have turkey nests out there. We're going to have other ground nesting birds, you know, but in grassland settings, we got quail, we got pheasants, we got other birds. And so we really have to think about, you know, some of the timing, you know, of some of the species we want to promote and we want to benefit. But that timing can also benefit us when it comes to the responses that we want.
Yes.
And I don't know if you guys have covered this in a previous podcast or not, but oftentimes, you know, the later you run fire, you know, into the spring, the more likely you are promoting more grasses, and it's kind of doing mm-hmm. more harm to some of the more broadleaves, the forbs and legumes. However, there comes a switch, you know, about late summer, July, August time period, to where actually if you run fire through much of those grasslands, you know, you actually kind of curtail or thin back some of the grasses, and you promote more broadleaves such
yes.
as forbs and legumes. And so, you know, some of that timing can be a key factor. The same thing, you know, here in Missouri, we often, and I'm going to throw the date out there, but I'll also tell you why. It's just a kind of a magical date, because really and truly green up, you know, in our timbered areas, if we're looking at a timber burn specifically, we don't want to do much past April 15th.
Mm-hmm.
It's number one for turkey nesting, but number two is because we're going to have green up of our timber, and that sap's really pushing up. And even though many of our trees are adapted, you know, the trees that we want to promote are adapted for fire, we still don't want to cause fire scarring any more than we have to, or cause any more damage necessarily than we have to. And so oftentimes we kind of shut that down, you know, simply to kind of minimize that, and, you know, call growing season burns. I think there's a benefit for growing season burns,
mm-hmm.
You know, but I think that happens. We should do that more though in July and August, you know, late July and August, more so than the late spring or early summer. I think
right.
it should be just later in the year. You know, but if we're going to think about kind of a growing season burn, but the long story short is timing has a major, major factor as well on the kind of response we get. And so, you know, and again, some of those things that I told you are more Missouri specific. So, you know, but each neighborhood, each area, each region is going to have slightly different variation of that. You know, but your local conservation department, you know, DNR, should be able to help you out with some of that. And if they have trouble, I would reach out to, depending on where you're at, I would also reach out to maybe Bureau of Land Management or the U.S. Forest Service or folks like that as well, because, you know, oftentimes they have folks that are, you know, you talk about some fire bugs, you know, those guys are arsonists, you know, they're just giving a license to run a match around.
Yep.
So, you know, but those guys have, you know, truly understand fire behavior oftentimes.
Definitely. Definitely. And that's important. Again, and I think that goes back to, you know, possibly some of the fears that are associated there with utilizing prescribed fire is just not knowing how fire behaves in different conditions. And we all know how weather can change rather drastically in a matter of minutes or hours. And topography plays a huge role into fire behavior, fuel loads. But you just have to get experience doing so. You just have to be around it to feel comfortable. And so if you're a landowner out there thinking, hey, I really, really want to try prescribed fire, well, reach out to those people who you know are using it. Join them on prescribed fires. Volunteer on the prep work all the way down to the execution of fire day and walk with them as they're, you know, putting the fire on the ground. Sit back and watch how that fire reacts in these different areas. How when it hits this grass patch, it'll you'll have a little bit higher flame height than when it slows back down, or when it hits a shaded spot versus a spot that's got sunlight, or different fuel loads in the leaf litter. It's incredible, but you can learn a lot about how fire reacts just by being out there. That sounds like a no-brainer, but if you're new to it, you have to have the experience to feel comfortable enough to getting it actually implemented there on your property. Brian, another question that always comes up when we're talking about doing prescribed fire. We chatted about it a little bit there at the beginning, but would you recommend in most cases, let's say someone wants to do prescribed fire and they need to do TSI first or in addition. A lot of the question becomes, is it okay for me to do TSI, dropping trees, open up the sunlight, and then do prescribed fire? Or would you recommend in most situations to prescribe fire first and then drop the trees? I know that's a loaded question. I know we chatted a little bit about it, but there's more there to unpack and unravel. A lot of the question, though, is based on fuel load, and that's the basis for, and not necessarily biological question, but.
And you're absolutely right. It has to do with fuel load, and so what you first have to, and again, it's a measurement. It's you've got to take an evaluation. How much fuel is on the ground right now, and then you have to look at what fuel you're going to be dropping. If you're cutting hardwoods in, that's what you're dropping, you know, on the ground, and say, even February, you know, January, February, and that's what you're putting on the ground, planning to burn in say March or April, you know, March or early April, or whatever time frame works best for you. Really and truly, that's not a big deal.
Not
you can go ahead
a big
and drop
deal
those.
At all.
You can go ahead and drop those.
Yes.
But if you're cutting trees, say in August or hardwoods in August or September, or you're dropping cedars, I highly recommend going ahead, especially if you have much of a fuel load there. You've never burnt before, and you have a lot of and what
a
I'm talking
up
about
of
fuel,
leaf litter.
Fuel in this situation is leaf litter.
Yes.
Exactly. So we want you, let's thin that leaf. Let's get rid of that long time buildup of fuel and leaf litter. Let's get rid of that. And then let's go ahead and do your TSI. And then about 2 to 3 years later, come back in with another fire regime. And so the whole purpose again for that is to reducing the amount of fuel, because I'm not worried about what we're dropping on the ground. What I'm worried about is what we're leaving.
Mm-hmm.
And so we don't want the fire to get too hot so that it scarifies or even kills, you know, the trees that we don't want. Because if we're doing TSI, we're selecting against trees, and
we're trying to promote healthier trees.
Exactly. So long story short is anything that we left standing, we obviously don't want damaged or harmed, which also leads up to the point too that if you've got some, you know, directional felling some of those trees at times is a big factor as well, because you don't want to, if you put a cedar on, you know, it may be two or three years before you do the next burn, you know, but if you go ahead and drop that cedar, or you go ahead and drop that other top right up against another tree, you know, that's standing that you want to continue to grow or to kind of be your seed tree, so to speak, well, you're probably going to scar it whenever you run fire through. So it's good. You know, you can also go back in after you drop them. And I can tell you it's a lot of work to do that, you know, but you can go back in and pull those tops away from those trees that you want to
you know, that you want to preserve, so to speak, or at least hoping to preserve.
Right.
So, you know, that's a, you know, so that's something that, you know, to keep in mind is just your field load. And oftentimes it does. It has to do with your leaf litter, you know, what you have on the ground before you drop. A little bit to do with timing, but species, obviously, because if it's cedar, regardless, it doesn't matter. You know, cedar is going to be hot regardless.
Yeah.
So, you know what I always recommend with cedar, if it's a, you know, if it's going to be a lot of cedar, the best thing that I recommend to do is go ahead, and if there is any leaf layer there, you know, oftentimes when you have a lot of cedar, you don't have a lot of leaf layer there anyway.
Nope.
But if it's a lot of cedar that's mixed in with some hardwoods and there's enough fuel there to go ahead and burn it, I definitely recommend burning it. If there's not enough to burn it, because the hardwoods are more scattered in there, I still recommend not to burn for 2 to 3 years, simply because in doing so, what you allow, you know, by dropping those trees, traditionally you've allowed that sunlight to kind of reach the forest floor. It doesn't help, you know, to pop any of those seeds necessarily that need that heat, you know, but what you're doing over that 2 to 3 years, you're allowing a lot of those cedar needles to fall off.
Yes.
And at least a high percentage of them to fall down and kind of melt, so that, you know, your fire in 2 to 3 years isn't nearly as intense or nearly as hot.
If you have a lot of cedars mixed into your timber and you try and burn it while the cedar is orange, that's a hot, hot fire.
Yeah.
Very high, yeah, high flame heights. As fire approaches a lot of these cedars, you will obviously be able to visually see the increase in the intensity of fire, but you will be able to hear it, the snapping, the crackling, the popping, and the sound of woof as that cedar goes up. So if we discourage that, and I was in Kansas this past week, and as a lot of people know, Kansas is getting certainly encroached by a lot of cedar in areas that don't get prescribed fire, similar to Oklahoma, Missouri, and other portions of the U.S. But in certain areas, saying, okay, you have just straight cedar and mixed in with kind of a more of a shorter grass prairie setting. But honestly, the number of cedars that are in here, come in with the tree shears, flat ground, shear them. You're going to have to wait for these to dry out. Because of the number that are here, I would not recommend then immediately after using prescribed fire. You will need to wait a couple years. Just let them lay, let them dry out, and then return with the prescribed fire. They will drop their cedar needles, and the sunlight will come in. You'll start to get that regeneration of the grasses and forbs that you're looking for. But if you do it too soon, I'm afraid that with the little experience of prescribed fire that you have, you will then not want to complete the rest of the project. And there was many areas that needed it. So if that's something new to you, definitely managing fuel loads is important. And another thing to keep and consider when using prescribed fire for the first time is, obviously, don't try and go out and burn 20 acres. Don't try and go do 40 acres or 100 acres. Do a very manageable section. Burn an acre. Learn how. Scale up over time. If you need to break up units and make them size-wise fit the number of people that you have there present that day, well, then do so. Don't bite off more than you can chew or feel comfortable with. Slowly graduate into larger burns that are maybe more complex, have more terrain in them. Just start very simple and work from there. But at the same time, as you're starting simple, working from there, go back and watch the response. Watch how, maybe set up a trail camera, because like you said, animals react to this. Animals are attracted to this within hours. And then as that green up occurs, there's a lot of activity associated around these birds. So be sure to monitor it, because again, you're just kind of test driving prescribed fire at that point. See if it's something that you want to do for the rest of the property. Most likely and hopefully it is that type of disturbance that you're choosing to use. But again, you don't have to jump in full force, dive in the deep end off the high dive. Start slow. work your way through the kiddie pool all the way to that deep end. Brian, what was your first fire experience?
Well, I'm probably a little different just because of how I got initiated. My first fire was a 600 acre burn.
Woo.
And it was a glade. It was actually a mountain to where, yep, we rung an entire mountain. So
wow.
My first experience is probably a little different, but we had a crew. I was on a crew with, you know, I was green and I didn't know. All I knew, I was supposed to stand up against a rake and make sure the fire didn't get on the wrong side of the line. So,
yep,
you know, that was but that was my first kind of experience with it. But to be honest with you, over the years, I've just having prior history with the our local state agency here in Missouri and living in the Ozarks, I've been on several thousands of acres, both prescribed burn and wildfire burns.
Uh-huh.
I guess my biggest wildfire burn was about 3,500 acres here in Missouri.
Wow.
And, you know, just it, but, you know, but that was, that took us, it was, I saw the sun, set a couple times on that burn.
I don't doubt that.
You know, but the long story short is, though, I mean, it's, you're right. Every single fire is different, and you should go ahead and experience one and start out small.
Mm-hmm.
But just remember that a grassland, you know, a key point is grassland burns are hot and scary, but they go fast.
Yes.
And woodland burns that, you know, oftentimes can fool you because they'll go slow and they'll kind of trickle and you think they're not going to take, and then all of a sudden they'll take. And so you've got, grassland burns are the ones that oftentimes have people on edge.
Mm-hmm.
And woodland burns, I think, are the ones that can sneak up on you.
Yes.
So, you know, kind of, you know, but on the bright side of things, your stress level, again, on a grassland burn, your stress level goes up real quick and it falls right back down pretty quick.
Yes.
On grassland burns, your stress level is kind of there at the beginning. Then you're like, I can kind of falter. You know, one that we did 2 weeks ago,
uh-huh,
you know, it was in a spot that honestly, you know, the whole fire, it was 119 acres. You know, and this was on a private contracting deal that I was doing.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, just honestly wasn't doing any, you know, wasn't burning as intensely as I wanted it to. But I knew it wasn't going to, because this is in a low-lying area, had springs and seeps, and
sure,
and we just knew it wasn't going to burn. It was just kind of essentially what we're doing with this is trying to burn out a little bit, as much of the perimeter as we possibly could. You know, but, you know, we were gone. We'd been gone 2 hours, you know, from a location.
Mm-hmm.
And yet we had just, you know, I just kind of told, I had three guys behind me, and I told one guy that was on a UTV. I said, hey, I said, you know what? I said, I need some rip torch fuel. Go ahead and go back and get me some. And I said, but go back up the line and, you know, either going to the truck or coming back just to kind of see, make sure that everything looks good. Well, and I'm glad that he did, because he had, you know, the wind had shifted a little bit,
right,
and had sparked an ember right in the middle of our fire line and had just started to creep outside of our fire line.
Wow.
And because this was actually, that fire line was a little different. We had a grass fire line, and this,
mm-hmm,
even though we're in a woodland setting, the fire line was about a 50-foot wide swath of grass.
Gotcha.
And I say grass, but it was mowed down to about about an inch and a half,
two inches
tall.
Right, right.
So, you know, but long story short is that had we not come back, it would have been, there was an uphill slope on the other side.
Eesh.
There's no telling where it would have been by the time we got a hold of it.
Sure.
You know, so, I mean, you know, like I said, I mean, we've been gone from that site for 2 hours.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and it had just skipped across. And so, you know, like I said, it's there, you know, those woodland burns and some of those situations, don't underestimate what they can do, you know, even a few hours later, especially when you have what we call heavy fuels. And I don't want to use too many terms, but heavy fuels are just fuels that will burn longer. I mean,
yes,
essentially log piles, you know, logs,
right,
or larger type items that will kind of smolder and simmer for a while.
Yeah.
But, you know, so, I mean, but, you know, that also highlights the point too. I mean, it's, I'm always one that once my burn is complete, I may sit there till dark, but I'm going to come back the next morning as well, just to kind of look at things, things over. And having said at dark, I can tell you if conditions are right, you know, you truly want to see a burn, you know, I highly recommend you seeing a nighttime burn.
Oh, man, yes.
You know, just, I mean, number one, I mean, you get to see the full effect, you know, a little more readily, you know, but also you get to kind of see things that you don't get to see during daylight, which are all the embers and the ash that are blowing across your line that you don't see during daytime. You know, and so it's kind of one of those things to where it makes you think, okay, humidity does matter, you know, and moisture levels and things like that do matter, because holy cow, you know, when you start seeing some of that stuff kind of filter across your line that you don't see during daytime, you're like, man, oh man, that's kind of, you know, I'd say don't do it on your first burn, you know, but I do recommend at some point in time, you know, do it a nighttime burn, because it's pretty amazing and kind of all, you know, you sit back and all, you know, looking at the fire and the flames, but, you know, it does make you think, like, holy cow.
Yeah, and it's neat to see that orange little strip of fire going down a slope, backing down a slope. Everything Absolutely. Else is just black and kind of has that midnight blue feel to it, and then you just see that little glow snapping, the crackling, the popping. You see a couple big logs that have been laying there forever, and they're smoldering a little bit. There's a neat little feel to it for sure. But Brian, I appreciate you taking the time to jump on the podcast here and chat about prescribed fire and different disturbances and managing the landscape. something we're all passionate about and we can all get behind. And to the point of the podcast, there's not a one rhyme or reason or a solution for every single property or every single timber unit. There's not a sequence of events that you can say is applicable to every single one that we face, that we come across, that's on your property. You know, every single property has its own unique bag of tricks or tools of the trade that need to be deployed at the right time with the right disturbance and adding the right amount of sunlight to it. It changes your landscape and changes the way you manage things. So, it's always fun to talk about it, Brian, especially with you, sir. And we appreciate everyone listening. And hopefully you get encouraged and just dig around for more information, educate yourself on prescribed fire as a technique and as a tool. And I know there's we have people write in all the time. There's states out there that you're not allowed to do it. And consider writing. Consider doing your research and sharing peer-reviewed articles about the benefits about prescribed fire and what it can do to a landscape, making it more healthy, rejuvenating it, sending it to the right people, because, again, everything within reason here and utilizing prescribed fire with the right hands can be a very valuable tool. So,
absolutely. And, you know, and I was just going to say, I mean, there's – you know, Missouri does not have burn laws, and there's some states that do and some states don't. And, you know, but yeah, if you are not allowed to use fire, I'd highly recommend looking at some of those states that do allow fire and recommending whether it's your legislature as well as your DNR and your forestry department to look at those, look to those states for guidance and assistance. And, you know, and if, and also I would definitely want to, you know, recommend folks to reach out to Land and Legacy, you know, talk about, you know, because you said have a plan. There's things, what's called the burn plan. There's templates out there. There's things that you can do. And I know you guys, you know, are well versed in that and definitely can help and assist with that.
Yeah.
At least give some generalities. Anyway.
For sure. Yeah. Helped actually communicate with a forester out of Maryland for a client to try and get them registered to be able to implement prescribed fire on their property. And just this past week, we had clients in Ohio who were burning, and then clients in Michigan as well. They did their first burn. They went through Michigan's prescribed fire workshop. You know what? Actually, I think it was a QDMA workshop with prescribed fire that they went through. So that's another program to kind of check out. Anyhow, They implemented their first prescribed fire, brought the family out there, and are managing the land with neighbors involved in everything. So that was a fantastic just kind of illustration of, hey, listen, you know, these are first time guys using prescribed fire. It can be done. It can be done safely and well. And I'm excited to kind of follow up with them and see exactly how it went and follow along with that progression of vegetation coming back, because Michigan, I don't know many people who burn there, but their landscape and their setting, certainly it was applicable, and I'm glad to see them implementing the plan and following through executing. So anyways, Brian, got anything else to add?
No, I definitely appreciate it. Like I said, it's kind of a, last week was going to everything wet to this week we're going to hoping for dry so we can burn. So yeah,
right.
Definitely going from one extreme to the other.
Yes, we are. Well, before we know it, hopefully we'll be chasing a turkey together.
I'm hoping, depending on when the podcast comes out, but April 6th is our youth season opens here in Missouri. So
I'm getting
excited. I've got a 13-year-old that he and I are itching to get out.
Man, that's great. That's great. Well, fantastic. Take care, Brian. Again, appreciate your time, sir.
Anytime.
Well, thanks, guys, for listening to this week's podcast, Habitat Heroes, talking with Brian Tal about prescribed fire. Man, there's just so much information out there and valuable resources to be able to latch on to and just manage and cover so many different acres and different types of vegetation, resetting that with prescribed fire. So, again, encourage you to continue reaching out to us with questions, info@landandlegacy.tv. And reach out to your conservation departments, DNRs, to learn more about what workshops are available out there for you guys. Appreciate you listening. Appreciate you following along. Check us out on Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, and landlegacy.tv. We'll catch you next week. See ya.